from the mouth, the palate became manifested, and thereupon the tongue was also generated. After this, all the different tastes came into existence so that the tongue can relish them. Okay, something to note right away is that two things are becoming manifested, the palate and the tongue. And I guess we manifested the mouth yesterday. And then after that, after the sense organs are there, then the sense objects, become manifested after the sense organ. Interesting. Okay. So, because kind of, you know, the modern conception is the opposite. At first, the flavors become manifested or something, and then the senses become manifested, driven by the flavors. Mm. Okay, let's go ahead here. Slide number 5. Okay, now first we put in, because of our particular German mentality and our desire to control everything, you always have to have some kind of perspective on the situation. Of course, this is the end of the second canto. First two cantos make a the lotus feet of Krishna. And the first canto is a nice preface. Who's talking to who about what? What's the situation? What's the purpose of the book? All those things are there. Maharaj Pariksit is facing his death. Kali Yuga is coming. We need a new incarnation. So the father is Sukadeva Goswami, and the mother is Maharaj Pariksit, to quote Srila Prabhupada. And then the second canto, we actually hear Sukadeva Goswami actually presenting his Bhagavatam after we're fully appreciating his position. And Maharaj Pariksit asking the questions. Okay, so they describe the creation of this world, the nature of this world, and where it's going, because we're in this world, and so if we can spiritualize this world, then we can spiritualize the soul, and then the soul can get out of this world, you know, which is pretty much the description. There's some descriptions of Dwarka and different spiritual relationships, and Brahma's darshan of the spiritual world, although the description is that's pretty much like Mahavishnu Loka, like that four-armed Narayan level, you know. Yeah, that's about all we've been, we're privy to at this point. Okay, so then after hearing how Narada Muni was instructed in this medical science of Srimad Bhagavatam, then in chapter 9, I think it was, chapter 9? Yeah. Then, it was chapter 8. Somewhere back there. Then Maharaj Pariksit asked a lot of questions. I guess it was 8. Questions by Maharaj Pariksit. Which is basically how did Narada Muni explain all these things? Yeah. And so then we'll see throughout the entire Bhagavatam, Narada Muni's preaching, all of his preaching activities. And eventually they'll answer all the questions of Maharaj Pariksit. And a lot of which have to do with the structure of the universe and these kind of things. Okay. So in the process then, Srimad Bhagavatam is the answer. And so in this, where are we here? Yeah. In the 10th chapter here, the 10 elements of Srimad Bhagavatam have already been described. So they are 2.10.1. Sarga, Visargas, Sarga, Visarga, Stanam, Poshanam, Utaya, Manvantar, Ishanukata, Niroda, Muktir, and Ashraya. And I think most everybody knows these. Sarga is the creation by Mahavishnu, Visarga is the creation by Brahma, and Stanam, we pretty much we're starting to talk now about the creation by the Manus, and then Poshanam, Stanam means fixed, Poshanam means nourishing, yeah, something like that. And then we get into the creation by the individual Lokapals, masters of the different planets. Utaya means to wake up or something. Then about the Manvantars is discussing all the instructions of the Manus given for human life to live properly. Isha Anukata is in about the different incarnations of the Supreme Lord. Niroda, winding everything up, and Muktir, leaving it all. And but the whole thing it's explaining is all under the Ashraya. So everything else is given. So we can really understand the Ashraya and really become very potent, powerful servants of him. Slide number 6. Now going after that, after 7, because one after another in this chapter we've seen them discussed. You know, Ashraya, Nirodha, Sthanam, Porshanam. Then in verse 7, it says, the Supreme One, who is celebrated as the Supreme Being or the Supreme Soul, is the Supreme Source of the cosmic manifestation as well as its reservoir and winding up. Thus he is the Supreme Fountainhead and the Absolute Truth. So we would say, having come to the summum bonum, the complete whole, the Ashraya, now Sukadeva Goswami is just continuing. That he's the Supreme Person, he is the Ashraya, he's the source, maintenance, and destruction of everything. And then number 8 then discusses, within this manifestation, what is this manifestation? And it's a topic that's coming up again and again. And this manifestation is the Adi-Atmak person, the Adi-Daivik person, and the Adi-Bhautik person. Yeah. So the Adi-Bhautik person is what we see, the body. Marilyn Monroe, what was his name? Jimmy Cagney, Madonna, horses, cats, grass. Okay, this is the Adi-Bhautik person. And the Adi-Atmak person is the individual Atma soul who animates that body. And the Adi-Daivik person are the demigods directly under the Supreme Lord, who are directly dealing with him to supply air, rain, heat, light, intelligence, all these things. Okay, so we're talking about the Ashraya and then how he's manifested in this world. And text number 10 goes back, not number 9. Number 9 goes back to the same thing. All 3 of the above-mentioned stages of the different living entities are interdependent. In the absence of one, another is not understood. But the Supreme Being, who sees every one of them as the shelter of the shelter, Ashraya, Ashraya, is independent of all, and therefore he is the supreme shelter. Okay, we're still talking about Ashraya and his deeds. Let me go to the next slide, number 7. And it's text number 10. After separating the different universes, the gigantic universal form of the Lord, Mahavishnu, the Ashraya, which came out of the causal ocean, the place of appearance for the first Purusha avatar, entered into each of the separate universes, desiring to lie on the created transcendental water. Okay, he wants to lie down on the transcendental water, Garbhodak. Number 11, text 11. That Supreme Person is not impersonal, and therefore is distinctively a Nara, or person. Therefore, the transcendental water created from the Supreme Lord is known as Nara. And because he lies down on the water, he is known as Narayana. Narayana. Okay. So the Supreme Lord's lying in the water. Next slide. Number 8. Haribol. Yeah. Now this is text number 12. One should definitely know that all material ingredients, activities, time, and modes, and the living entities who are meant to enjoy them all, exist only by his mercy. And as soon as he does not care for them, everything becomes non-existent. Okay, so you see Ashraya in a continuous sense, that just like I can't ask, can you bring me some tennis? No, tennis is a game, and it requires the intimate attention of people from moment to moment. It's an energy, and the energetics are on the tennis court playing. And so the same way, the moment that the Paramatma, Mahavishnu, Purusha avatars neglect the material world, the ingredients, the activities, time, whoop, the whole show stops. So every single moment, you know, the thing is being maintained by Mahavishnu. Okay. Slide number nine. Text 13. The Lord, while lying on his bed of mystic slumber, generated the seminal symbol, golden in hue, through external energy out of his desire to manifest varieties of living entities from himself alone. Just hear from me how the potency of his lordship divides into three, called the controlling entities, the controlled entities, and the material bodies, in the manner mentioned above. So this is very common, no? Adiatmic, Adidaivic, and Adibhautik. And of course, each of these have their associated miseries. Adiatmic klesha, Adidaivic klesha. Yeah. So that was in text number 280, it was mentioned. Okay, let's see what else we got here. Okay, so next slide, number 10. Okay. Text 15 then starts to describe this axial sequential creation. From the sky situated within the transcendental body of the manifesting Mahavishnu, sense energy, oja, mental force, and bodily strength, sahabalam, sense energy, mental force, bodily strength, are all generated, as well as the sum total of the fountainhead of the total living force, prana. As the followers of a king follow their lord, similarly, when the total energy is in motion, all other living entities move, and when the total energy stops endeavoring, all other living entities stop sensual activity. The living force, being agitated by the Virat Purush, generated hunger and thirst, and when he desired to drink and eat, the mouth opened. This is kind of interesting. Comes to mind here that the first thing is actually anamaya. That's the first condition for the Virat Purush also, is that eating and drinking, sustenance, are the first level, the first archetypal images. Okay, let's go to the next slide here if we can. Okay. And then 210.17, then we'll see sequentially what happens. 210.17, 18, 19, 20, 21, all the way down to 30 is describing a creation of different kinds of motivations and their satisfactions. For example, 210.17 is talking about the creation of hunger and thirst, followed by the desire and the ability to drink and eat. And so a mouth is created. 18 today says the mouth creates the palate creates the tongue, and then different tastes are created, so the tongue can taste those. 19, he desires to speak, and so speeches can be created, so the mouth and the controlling deity, fire, comes from the mouth. 20, smells and odors, and then the nostrils and respiration are created. And the nose, and the deity of them all, which is the air. 21, he desires to see himself, and so the eyes are created, and the sun god, the predominating deity, and the power of vision, and the objects of sight. So the rest of the chapter is like that. It's actually a very interesting cosmology, where it all came from, how it all was created. And then a next slide here, going down to number 12, is actually Prabhupada's purport, which is actually pretty short. In the purport, Prabhupada says, this gradual process of evolution suggests the explanation of the controlling deities, Adidaiva, because Varuna is the controlling deity for all relishable juices. Therefore, the mouth becomes the resting place for the tongue, which tastes all the different juices of which the controlling deity is Varuna. This suggests, therefore, that Varuna was also generated along with the development of the tongue. And we can talk here about the tongue as a general principle. You know, it's like if you drop a piece of glass on the floor, a big piece of mirror or something, and a mirror glass, swam, and then suddenly there's, you know, dozens of little mirrors, all with the same potency. So the same way the Virat Rup creates his tongue, and everybody has tongues. Ants appear to have tongues in their feet, you know. Everybody had different kinds of tongues, like this and that. So it's like an echo, again, macrocosmic and microcosmic resonance. Okay, so the Varuna was generated along with the development of the tongue. So the demigod has to be there to kind of manage the impersonal element. The tongue and the palate, being instrumental, are adi bhutam, or forms of matter. So we got Adi Daiva, which is the demigod, Varuna, and Adi Bhuta, or the forms of matter. But the functioning deity, who is the living entity, is Adi Daiva, who is a living entity, is Adi Daiva, whereas the person undergoing the function is Adi Atma. Seems like we're passengers in the amusement park rather than enjoying the thing, controlling the thing. Okay, next slide, number 13. Thus, the three categories are also explained as to their birth after the opening of the mouth of the Virat Purush. The four principles mentioned in this verse, I could understand that was mouth, palate, tongue, and taste. Okay, the four principles mentioned in this verse serve to explain the three main principles, namely the Adiatma, Adidaiva, and Adibhuta, as explained before. Okay, so that's pretty clear. I think now it's becoming how our cosmology, because Maharaj was discussing a little bit yesterday, and I tried to look up his free book there. I almost got it downloaded. It's a Cosmology on Trial. I mentioned there was also a book by a professor of law from the University of California in Berkeley quite some time ago, Professor Johnson, called Darwin on Trial. And it got a big reaction. Stephen Gould, I think he was one of the big professors of evolution biology from Harvard, he even wrote a rebuttal in one big scientific journal. And it's also a good book, too, because he's called Darwin on Trial. So I haven't looked at Cosmology on Trial, and maybe he's going to mention him like that. So it's all, after this, okay, next slide here, number 14. Okay, yeah. So what I was kind of maybe focusing on a little bit here is science. Somebody going by there, one of the donkeys going by outside. Science and other cosmologies. Science and other cosmologies. Of course, we're one of the other cosmologies. Yeah, and if you go to our next slide, number 15, you see we're going to present here Vine, I think it's called Vine, that's how it's pronounced, V-I-N-E, Victor Deloria, D-E-L-O-R-I-A, Jr., Vine Victor Deloria, okay? And he was born March 26, 1933, and left his body November 13th, 2005. He was an American Indian, author, theologian, historian, and activist. He was widely known for his book, Custer Died for Your Sins, an American Indian, an Indian Manifesto, 1969. He was professor of political science at the University of Arizona, 1978 to 1990. And he was also a university professor before and after that, but a different place. And was influential in the development of what scientific critics called American Indian creationism, but which American Indians referred to as defense against scientific racism, like that. So if you've got our slideshow, we have his picture there as a somewhat young man, and a picture of an American Indian over there, like that. And our whole culture is very, you know, if we were all decked out in uttariya and dhoti and, you know, tilak and sika and all this kind of stuff, kavachas and this kind of stuff, you know, Native American Indians would probably look at us and think, yeah, these guys are my kind of people, like that, you know. So I actually met him. He was at one conference organized by the Isthmus Foundation in Texas. I don't know if they still exist. But their idea was to make an isthmus, a little bridge between science and religion. And most of their membership was actually doctors, physicians. So he was one of the speakers at one of their presentations there. And he presented, you know, he was one of the, probably the biggest American Indian advocate like that. So that's good. And also, it's interesting, his father, I think he was born up in the Dakotas or something, you know. And his father was and his grandfather were something like Episcopal ministers. They were Episcopal ministers. And let's go on down here and see what else. This is all from the Wikipedia. Good old Wikipedia. Okay. Deloria's, next slide, number 16. Deloria's position on the age of certain geological formations, the length of time American Indians, Native Americans, have been in the Americas, their possible coexistence with dinosaurs, etc., were influential in the development of American Indian defenses against scientific racism. Now, I think I mentioned before that, you know, black people also are, you know, point out that science is also a very racist thing. And I would say one of their most prominent books, which is also, you can also buy it and have fun reading, is called Even the Rat Was White, Racial Prejudice in Psychology. You know, again, we mentioned that because, you know, you can't trust in black rats. You know, so you got to have a white rat. Like that. Yeah. So very interesting, just a few words, and you begin to expose that the king has no clothes. Okay, racial prejudice in psychology. Even the rat was white. And Custer died for your sins. So we're beginning to get an army here together. You know, we got Hare Krishnas, black folk, and Native American Indians are all kind of getting together. Okay, so yeah. His ideas, reading again here, this generally, okay, what is it called? American, Native American creationism. This generally rejects scientific explanations of origins of indigenous people in America that contradict American Indian accounts. Deloria argued that scientists are virtually incapable of independent thinking and are hobbled by their reverence for orthodoxy. Now, this is very interesting in terms of preaching to the scientists. It says here, his opinion is, they are virtually incapable of independent thinking. Okay? So don't try and present ideas expecting that they're going to independently change their ideas. And are hobbled by reverence for orthodoxy. Okay? So that means that they're hobbled, but also that if you can appeal to their orthodoxy, then they're going to be able to think your thoughts. You're going to put it in their language. You're going to put it in their power structure. So-and-so says, you know, yeah. And then we'll be able to try and communicate with them according to his perspective and also ours. He noted that scientists characteristically persecute those who dare to advance unorthodox views, and thus science is essentially a religion. Very nice. If you make a 501c3 nonprofit religious corporation, which is what, you know, IRS tax exempt, which is what I guess all of our, you know, United States temples are. We have we're all classified as churches. To become a religion is not so hard in California, but to become a church is pretty rigorous. And there's like about, I think what it is, like 15 or 20 different things that they consider you have to satisfy to be called a church, as opposed to just a religion or a nonprofit organization like that.
And actually, they're pretty good. And you don't have to satisfy all of them. So here's a really great slideshow or a movie. And just take what the IRS decides what classifies as a church. And then go ahead and find the proper images. One thing, is there a separate priest class from the laity? So then we have, yes, science definitely has a definitely a separate priest class from the lay folk. Is there a systematic process for educating young people in the community? Oh, yes. You can show the little children being taken through the evolution exhibition at the museum, little experiments being trained like this and that. You know? Another thing of criticism is that religion has its dogmas and its ideas in an arcane language that only the initiated priest class can understand. And you become initiated by formal rituals. So there we have the people being receiving their PhD diplomas with everybody dressed up in their caps and gowns. And, of course, the arcane language is scientific terminology, which doesn't have a lot to do with normal, ordinary English, which is in the essence, which is mathematics, which is completely incomprehensible. To understand the theories of creation, which are expressed in mathematics, you have to go through, you know, arithmetic, geometry, analytical geometry, trigonometry, calculus, and then what else? You go university level, graduate level, something like, what is it, you know, 16 years of mathematics being trained in the arcane language before you can understand what they're talking about. So you go through it one after another, and Deloria's, you know, hypothesis has seen very much that a lot of criticism can be very simply, you know, leveled at, on the one side, the science is a religion, like that, which Albert Einstein called scientism, not science. On the other side is something else. You know, it's a philosophical system, we would say, like that. Yeah. Okay, so we have a picture here, if you can see it, of the trial of Galileo, you know, now how he was persecuted because he dared to advance unorthodox views at his time. So we'll come back to him later. Let's go ahead here. Number 17. Deloria has been criticized for his embrace of American Indian traditional histories by such scholars as Bernard Ortiz de Montejano and H. David Brumbel, who say that such views are not supported by the scientific and physical evidence and contribute to the problems of pseudoscience. Okay, and the citation is from Postmodern Multiculturalism and Scientific Illiteracy, published in the American Physical Society Journal, 1998. But this is kind of like what we would call an oxymoron or a tautology. He's saying that what he's presenting is not a scientific cosmology, and they're criticizing him because his cosmology is not scientific. So that's the whole kind of point. Is that science, dogmatically establishes itself as the only way of knowing, which, of course, is not scientific. Okay, we continue. Deloria often cited American creation accounts and oral traditions to support his views relating to science. He also relied on Hindu creationists such as Michael Cremo. Jai. Right there in the Wikipedia. So maybe that was from our contact with him. He then became interested. See a picture of Sariputta and Uttakarma in their secular dress. Yeah. So you can see our work is becoming useful to other people like that. Yeah. Of course, and here's the point too, is that all these people, when you go to this intellectual area, you know, you'll get a fight. You know, you'll get a fight. And so they have their authorities and they're quoting, and these are intelligent people too, you know. So their arguments are many times not so very good emotionally or anything else, or common sense. But they tend to be logical and rational. Okay. Nicholas Perov, next slide, number 18. Nicholas Perov wrote that, quote, throughout the years, most notably, perhaps in his book, you know, Deloria's book, the metaphysics of modern existence, and Red Earth, White Lies, Deloria has rarely missed a chance to argue that the realities of pre-contact American Indian experience and tradition cannot be recognized or understood within any conceptual framework built by the theories of modern science. Which is a nice point. And, in fact, Nicholas continues, it is certainly true that no one with or without the aid of scientific theories and concepts can, in any absolute meaning of the word, know what life was like as a member of the Menominee tribe 600 years ago. But we can imagine what it was like. So Petrov is actually an expert on this tribe of Indians, which still exist and still have many traditions carried down. So very good point from our side then. Again, we've got people who are in our favor. They're making this point. But yes, the scientific paradigm, at least it can't cover everything. And even I've seen that the scientific position has softened. So many of them are starting to accept that, yes, you know, that science doesn't explain everything, at least today. In the future, maybe we'll do it. Okay, yeah, we're going to do it or something. But at least right now, yes, it does not explain everything. But what it does explain, oh, you know, it explains the best. So the dog is no longer claiming the entire block as his propriety, but he's claiming his yard like that. Yeah. Okay, let's go on here. Okay. Next is slide number 19. Deloria's critics on this issue include Bruce Thornton, who published The Plagues of the Mind, The New Epidemic of False Knowledge. David Brumble, who published Vin Deloria Jr., Creationism and Ethnic Pseudoscience. George Johnson, quote, who produced an article called Indian Tribes, Creationists Thwart Archaeologists. And finally, they mentioned John C. Whitaker, who, quote, Red Earth, White Lies, Native Americans and the Myth of Scientific Fact. Okay. So it's going on, that the preaching is going on in this fashion. We have another picture of Galileo here at the Inquisition, facing the evil priests and the evil monks. Let's go down then. Okay, slide number 20. Okay, so that's kind of the end of the Wikipedia article, which is very nice. Next slide, we have a picture of Vin Delorean in his more mature years with his coffee cup and his typewriter. And actually, the things he brought up in the conference when he was in Texas there were very interesting, you know. He made very good points. It was amazing. From a totally independent point of view, he was supporting our cosmology and our view of the world. And he said that you white people, you North American, Northern German guys, you invaders, he said, your race have always been very good metal workers. Your race has always been very good metal workers. And, of course, we know that the American Indians are supposed to have called the telegraph the talking wire and the railroad train as the iron horse. Yeah, iron horse. And microchips, what are they? You know, microchips are just extremely high-tech, metal work. So you put it in perspective that, you know, we're good metal workers. And it's not surprising coming from northern Germany where you're fighting against ice and that kind of stuff, that you need steel, you know. And he also made another point. He said, your people have always been favored by sky gods, sky gods. And so as far as I know, in the Second World War, it was won through air power. And also I know that was it. In the Pacific War, people were thinking in the beginning it was going to be a battle between capital ships. It's been big battleships, the Bismarck, the Grasse Bay, you know. But in the end, very quickly it became obvious that the battle was between the aircraft carriers. So in the end, he's a very insightful fellow. You know, our people are good metal workers. We've been favored by sky gods. Then he mentioned that if you told like a Sioux medicine man, a Sioux Indian medicine man, you know, about your creation story, you know, atoms, molecules, all this kind of stuff. He said he might listen to you through the whole thing, you know, and he might comment. He said, well, you know, it just might work, but you probably have to add one crow and one fox to get it off like that, to get it moving. So he's a very, very sarcastic guy, a lawyer, you know. Then he told a personal story. He said his mother had a fever, you know, some kind of like liver infection or something, and the doctor said, she's just not going to make it. I'm sorry. We're trying our best, but the fever is going to be too much, and she'll die, you know. So he got on the telephone and called up a medicine man, a shaman, and he was kind of saying, he said, even from our perspective, he said, I was kind of a little bit of a curious about a shaman who has a cell phone. But he said he called the guy up and he said, yeah, Vim, what's going on? He said, my mother's getting his fever, you know, and this and that. Can you deal with your spirit? Because these guys do these things. And they get connected up to some Gandharva, some Kushmanda, some Vinayaka or something. They become adopted, like a dog becoming adopted. And then they make deals with them, like this and that. If you do this for me, I'll drink some alcohol and get drunk and you can experience being drunk and singing and this and that, you know, or whatever it is they want. They satisfy their associate. So the guy said, okay, you know, $25, $125, whatever it is, you know, I got to buy a case of whiskey, this and that. So then what he did, the medicine man guy, you know, got his Gandharva or whatever it was to enter into her subtle body and take the heat, you know. And so finally the body was able to recover, and she recovered. And then he went back there, and the doctor said, well, Vin, it's a miracle. She recovered. I guess our medical treatment really, really worked this time. It doesn't work normally, but this time it worked. And he said, yeah. Get my mother out of there. So that was his explanation of how it worked. You know, it's a science. It's scientific. There's a clear thing there which can be tested in certain ways like that. But it's going to require a different kind of testing or a different kind of cosmology than is going to be produced by a bunch of Nazi Germans, you know, trying to fight their way through the Red Winter with iron tanks, you know. It's a different kind of cosmology. Next slide. Okay. And coming down here, yeah. Other cosmologies. So we got the black people, American Indians, Hare Krishnas. And, well, of course, we've been mentioning we're also working on Carl Jung, which is a community, very nice community, still an active community, you know, and mentioned. And, of course, Jung, he was getting a little bit into trying to adjudicate his view of psychology. Because in 1897 or whatever, 1905, you know, science was really getting going. Thermodynamics was becoming so powerful. You know, there's a conservation of energy, you know, entropy. And nobody knows why these things were accepted. You know, there's this universal law that all energy is conserved. But if you look for the source, you know, the honest scientists will say, what's his name, like Feynman, Nobel laureate, a pretty honest guy. He said it's called the law of conservation of energy because in every single case we know it's true that if you get a certain amount of electrical energy, it can be converted into a measurable amount of magnetic energy like that, you know. So but Jung tried for a little bit to put science on that basis that the libido, the psychic energy was, you know, fixed amount. But he got pretty much right into alchemy. He discovered alchemy. And alchemy was a real competitor with physics in the beginning. But somehow or other, physics won, and this mechanistic view took off. And so we find in many of the alchemic ideas and their works very resonant with our philosophy. And then Harvey Cox, he was a professor at Harvard, and he was the keynote speaker for our 1984 symposium for the Bhaktivedanta Institute in Bombay. And I saw the book is there. The book that was produced out of it is called A Synthesis of Science and Religion. So you can find copies on Amazon has them, I think. There's one kind of photocopy or something which is going for $150. But it looks like some of the other books used are there. There's two. One is Thoughts on a Synthesis of Science and Religion, which is later by Srutadhamadhar. But the original one is very nice. There's some nice articles in there. I helped do it. And especially is Harvey Cox's keynote address where he talks about the history of science and religion. And, of course, he's not a lightweight guy. He's a theologian from Harvard University, and he gives very solid citations. And he offers his contrasting thing of science and religion. He titled it A Lover's Quarrel, Science and Religion. Science and Religion, A Lover's Quarrel, you know. A little garland at the feet of Radha and Krishna on the anniversary of Lord Chaitanya's birth, like that. Yeah. And then one last thing, there was a very good movie called Science, Fiction, produced by the BBC, and it won awards with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And it's hard to track down. Somehow or other, I was looking at WorldCat.org, World Catalog, WorldCat, and some university has a copy of it, but then I lost it, you know. But it was such a very good movie, you know, showing all these things and interviewing scientists. So definitely somehow or other in this area, try and get this movie. I'll try and track it down, or somebody else can get it. Science, Fiction. You'll find a lot of other things coming up under that title, but this is one which I think the University of Pennsylvania or somebody has a copy still. It doesn't show up with the BBC. Okay, finish off with our last slide here, which is the Mahatma. Okay. First off, we're talking about Galileo. We've been putting him here as our in. And it says at the age of 70, Galileo, when he was simply trying to change, you know, the worldview from a geocentric view to a heliocentric view. And he was saying that the view of putting the Earth in the center of everything and trying to calculate all the orbits of the planets wasn't very efficient, and it really, we should look at it from the point of view of the sun. And in the West, this was considered so blasphemous, everything else, that it caused all this controversy, and some people attacked him. And then the Pope, because actually, here's the interesting thing, you know, the Pope was actually inclined towards his view, you know. So he told him, write a book, present both ideas, he said, but don't try and preach the heliocentric view. Just give both presentations a fair thing like that. But he did it in such an insulting way that even the Pope was criticized. The Pope was put off with the guy, had more important things to deal with, and then he was brought before the Inquisition, like that. And he was arguing his view. So and this is kind of a controversial point whether it actually happened or not. But as they say that the aged Galileo in his 70s was taken down into the dungeons of the church and shown the instruments of torture that were going to be used on him if he did not recant. Fearing the torture and fearing that he might share the same fate as Giordano Bruno, whom the church burned at the stake a generation earlier for the same crime, Galileo recanted the truth. And it's this famous thing that under his breath he said, it still moves, you know. So it's kind of interesting that when the church was in power, they were torturing and threatening the scientists. And now on the opposite side, when the scientists are in power and have state support, you know, for the things they give the state, then they're threatening and harassing other people like that. And of course, they aren't, you know, tossing people into jail and stuff so much, showing them the instruments of torture. You know, you'll keep your job, but it'll be in the basement. You won't get any funding, and we'll ridicule you in public. You know, all the scientists will say you're an idiot, you know, like this and that, you know. And maybe we'll keep you around just for the point of, as an example of what happens to people who fight our orthodoxy. You know. So Mahatma Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Very interesting. Let's say maybe Prabhupada took that from Gandhi or something, you know. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So very interesting perspective on what preaching means. First you try it, nobody pays any attention to you. Then you bring your ideas in, they start to ridicule you, you know, some out of sincerity and some out of a desire to put you down. And then when they see it's going on, the fight actually starts. Sarabhauma Bhattacharya and Lord Chaitanya. And then if you go on and persist, the idea is then you win. Okay, so that's our humble presentation on alternative cosmologies and where that little thing between your teeth came from. Hare Krishna, any questions, complaints, anxieties, or whatever?
I'm sorry, I'm messing around with the slideshow here. Slow. Sorry, just one second. I messed up the last slide. Anyway, whatever. Hold on. Okay, Prabhu. Does anyone have any questions or comments?
Raj, you mentioned the subject of being accused of racism. I've heard it alleged against us when, I believe it was in the Bhagavatam, with the chewing of King Vena, his legs, and Bahuka is produced with the copper hair and King Karomi, meaning, you know, I am your servant. What are your thoughts on that?
My first thought is that it's the, what is it, DDPP, Daksha Druva Pitu Pacheta. So somebody's got an echo going there. Maybe your speaker's feeding back into your microphone, somebody. Yeah. I would say that our point is that now we got, oh, here's a static. Okay, yeah. Our point is that this is not even comprehensible. We're taking the same point as Vindaloriya, that this, it says, directly says, 2.2.12, don't read beyond the second canto as long as you are still engaged in gross illicit sex. Okay? Yeah, gross illicit sex. Because if you are, you're going to be so much in the bodily concept of life, you won't be able to judge these things from an objective point of view like that. You know, you think you are a woman. You think you are black. You think you are a Protestant white man. You think you are, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's not even possible to understand whether this is true or not and how our different races. But other than that, I would say, yeah, we do say, you know, that men and women are different. Children and women are different. You know, children and dogs are different. Dogs and cats are different. You know, different races are different in many different levels. And the subtle body and the karma and the destiny are different. And there's no such thing as good or bad as soon as we connect it all to Krishna. You know, everything comes from Krishna, and then there's no such thing at that point. When everything is in its proper position, then everybody can be the very best and achieve the very highest destination. That's what my perspective would be. But, of course, it depends on who you're talking to. You know?
No, it's a good answer. Yeah, we make a distinction, and we differentiate, but we don't discriminate.
Yeah, we discriminate, but we're not prejudiced. Prejudice. We don't judge things, you know, but before taking in all the facts, like that.
Right.
And we discriminate for everybody's benefit. Yeah, yeah.
You know what Eisenhower means in German?
No, I don't. What does it mean?
Iron worker.
Oh, Eisenhower. Wow. Yeah.
So the Native Americans don't like that. See, the Americans came in to conquer, and they said, well, somebody was here before you. Everybody came from somewhere. They said, no, we have always been here. And
yeah.
They say, no, you came over the land bridge from the Bering Straits. And they say, one of the Indian spokesmen said, there was no one-way sign up there. Maybe we traveled up and went over to Russia. See, I like to say that about pre-Christian Europe also. Civilization came from the Fertile Crescent. They completely cut off India. But I think Plato was educated in India. So there was no one-way sign between Europe and the United States. It's much closer than the Bering Straits and New Mexico.
It is a lot of, but it was a lot of travel between the Middle East and India.
Who knows what was in that library of Alexandria that they burned down?
Oh yeah.
No.
I was told that one of the rules was every ship that came into the harbor, the librarians were enforced. You know, soldiers would come on board if you wouldn't agree to it. They had had the right to go through the entire ship, and any book they saw they liked, they had a right to make a copy of it.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous library. Yeah. And of course, you know, it's the whole thing, archaeology, that they're discovering more and more things. It goes on and on like that. So on. So anyway, it's one area of preaching, and it's kind of like, you know, it's nice to know some basic principles, and to know some people who can talk in more depth if we have to, you know, about it. Because science, yeah, people still respect science as our predominating way of knowing things like that. Even the Catholic Church and other people are capitulating to the scientists in many ways.
In Boston, I spoke to Harvey Cox's class. And I said, don't let anybody tell you that you worship and then you merge into a void. And they all said, that's all he's been telling us. And he walked out. I have that effect on people.
Oh, my goodness.
He didn't like. Sorry.
Your voice fills the room. And people have to make room for it.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, preaching is a whole strategy. I mean, you really kind of got to, like I say, you got to know the people, no? You got to know the people. Yeah.
Everyone should see the documentary by Ben Stein called Expelled, No Intelligence Necessary, how professors are losing tenure or getting fired if they even hint at intelligent design or creation.
Yeah, I saw a promo for that.
Yeah. Oh, see it. You can get it on YouTube for free.
Expelled. So we, at this conference, we did in DeLorean.
No intelligence allowed.
Allowed.
Expelled.
Yeah. No intelligence
allowed. Allowed.
Yeah. So, then DeLorean.
Dandavats, there's a plan in Mayapur. I got a truck outside anyway. Hang on.
Of course, that was the whole thing.
And the main dome in this planetarium, yeah, this new temple, there is going to be a presentation to Brihadbhagavatamrita, which was the original idea. But there's a separate group working on one of the side domes to present Vedic cosmology from some notes from Sataputta. But there was a meeting in the courtyard next to the temple when I was there in Mayapur this last Gaurpurnima, where they were, one of the speakers was describing how when the scientists see that everything is supported by elephants, you know, they'll get it. I'm paraphrasing. But I was like, my jaw was on the ground. You know, this presentation, Deloria, is saying that the scientists, they're racist. Not only they're racist, but they're, you know, so caught up in their own orthodoxy that it's practically a dogma. They don't have the ability for independent thinking. They don't have a broad view of things. Like Achyutananda Prabhu said the other day, if we don't know it doesn't exist, something like that, or if we can't see it, we don't believe it, or, you know, that sort of attitude. So I was surprised that the devotees were thinking by producing some Vedic model, you know, making an attempt through some notes from someone who's gone from this world, that they were going to cobble together something that was going to overwhelm the scientists.
Most scientists probably won't even go to India. They're so afraid of it.
Right. Well, this project's on the international stage, and it's what comes to my mind is it would set us up for ridicule. Something like your quote from Gandhi.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you want to. You know, especially there's no consensus anyway. I mean, to make a model like this is like, it's practically impossible anyway. Bhumandal, there's so many ideas about all that stuff.
The of course, it was part of Prabhupada's. It's interesting because it's Ravindra Swarup did this whole review through the harmonists and everything else. And this was a part of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's strategy, you know, along with the doll making and everything else, to show it. And then the planetarium, of course, he wasn't going to come to the West. So it wasn't something that Prabhupada very acutely saw the environment, saw the atmosphere, and decided, you know, for the frontal attack, which he did, considering, like, how many people were going to understand, how many people are not going to understand, like that, you know. And so it's a whole thing. It's a big point about strategy and perspective, like you're talking about, what is going to be appropriate or not, whether we should wear tilak in these presentations or have hair or not have hair, you know. But so that's, you know, that's a whole point. I could see, there's also another point, though, in perspective, though, is the way that Bhaktisiddhanta was talking about this thing. And Ravindra Swarup said it was just coming through again and again. It was like shocking him. Was that the whole planetarium, the way it's designed, it moves. It's a moving thing, and you're up in the upper gallery, which is like, I guess, you know, three stories above the ground, and the dome is like maybe seven stories. You know, it's four stories more. So you're watching the whole thing above you, like a planetarium type thing, and it's moving, and it's showing the relationships between the different things. You know, trying, like you see, to get the model and everything else like that and so on. Yeah? And as you do that, it's a yantra. It's not only just a demonstration, but it's a yantra which then allows for people to go back and forth between Navadvipa in the spiritual world and Navadvipa in the material world. So when the whole thing is set into motion, the first person who pushes the switch, there's going to be a change in the cosmic stargate like that. He was saying it was like, you know, again and again, it's not just an ordinary thing. It's just like the way Bhaktisiddhanta was talking about it is that the modern mind, the German mentality, when it was put into a model like that, their mentality, then they would begin to get some scope and perspective on what's being talked about. And of course, if you do look, for example, Sadaputta's movie, he has a movie, Sacred Geometry. It's on the YouTube. You can download it. And he goes through and gives a very nice explanation of the fifth canto and points out, you know, how it is, you know, extremely rational and organized. And at the very least, it's supposed to be like, you know, 1,400 years old, at the very least. And so how do these people at that level have such a sophisticated idea? But, yeah, it's a point about who's supposed to be seeing it, what's happening, what class of people. Because on the other hand, we do get scientists like Charles Townes, the inventor of the laser, Nobel laureate, you know, participating in our programs, liking them, interested, you know, and George Wald, the Nobel laureate. So it's a whole area, like you say, very pragmatic about what the result is. Is Sarvabhauma? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya did not accept, you know, Lord Chaitanya's statement. And then he argued, but then, you know, he was convinced like that. Actually, Lord Chaitanya had to show a miracle, you know, to finally convince him, you know. So,
Maharaj, this is Mahesh here. But, you know, ultimately, all of these theories and even the stories from the Bhagavatam, we are seeing them through the eyes of the guru. The guru, in this case, Swami Prabhupada, he brought the Srimad Bhagavatam to the West. And we are seeing that story or that conception of the universe through the eyes of the guru. And without the devotee's mercy or association or teachings, whatever, you know, without that mercy from the devotee, no one else can see that
construction of the universe. So you can have the most expensive planetarium in the world, and the best the best built planetarium, but unless we have a guru or accept that those teachings from the guru, no one will really be able to understand it, isn't it?
No, I object. I object to your last word. Won't be able to understand a piece of it. So, for example, the absolute truth can be understood in the very general sense as Brahman. It can be understood as very more specific with details as Paramatma. And it can be understood finally in a personal relationship as Bhagavan. So the guru is also Jesus Christ. He's also the Logos. He's telling people there is a spiritual world. You know, you don't die, Muhammad. So the general information, Prabhupada's not giving anything different. You know, he's giving the basic perspective that there is a harmony in this world between elements, and then we can find those out. So we also accept the scientific view, you know, when we start to see these things. But then the maturity is we begin to see that, okay, there's a controlling feature. It's not just impersonal, you know, laws. So in that respect, Prabhupada's mercy has gone out. You see so many theologians now. They don't even know where the arguments are coming from, but they're using Prabhupada's arguments because they've got them through their gurus, which may have been their own students, like that. And because of that, they're beginning to see, yeah, there is somebody in the universe. So I would say understanding Prabhupada on different levels, Prabhupada's giving a general perspective on what is reality, which many people can accept. He's giving more detailed perspective, which fewer people can accept. And he's giving actually access into the most confidential pastimes, Radha and Krishna, which probably none of us at this point can take much advantage of. So in that respect, I would say, yeah, that Prabhupada's mercy is there. And some people, yeah, they're not getting much of it. They hate it. So they'll never understand. And it's Kali Yuga. So I would say a lot of people will never understand, you know.
You know, Maharaj, it's planes of consciousness, isn't it? Isn't that what we're dealing with Brihat Bhagavatamrita? It's subjective. You know, when you try to make it objective, that's when you run into problems. You're playing into their strength. You know, just like the Indians recognize these are good metal workers, or they have their area. So these scientists, they're mathematicians, and they have their view of things through mathematics. But philosophically, when you approach the same subject matter, it becomes different if you approach it through the eyes of Shastra, through, you know, a book like Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and then it becomes planes of consciousness.
But that's the whole point, that the chitta, the consciousness, then becomes matter. And when it becomes matter, it becomes accessible and observable by anybody. I wouldn't say by anybody, by people on this gross level. And so the whole material world is just created just for that purpose. So those people whose consciousness is absorbed into the external world can start to take lessons, you know, from the external manifestation. And so people like Sariputta, one time he was engaged in an argument with John Searle at this big congress we had in Bombay, Synthesis of Science and Religion. And Searle was the University of California professor. What's the name for the title of it? It's called the University Lecturer. All the professors at the University of California then elect one person each year to be the lecturer. And he's supposed to give like three lectures. And he did it. So he was a heavy dude, you know, head logician and materialist. So he and Sariputta got in this argument, you know, about, you know, the origin of life and matter and using very specific physical examples and everything else, you know. And it was going on, the audience was very electrified, big scientists, you know, and so on. So afterwards, when it was all over, Searle came back, was back to me, one of them said, Thompson, you know, I don't want to say I agree with your arguments, but I fought these things with many, many theologians before, and I want to tell you, you play a good game of hardball. Like that. So he was very convinced, at least the arguments can be supported
from, like you're saying, from a very mathematical and hard empirical level like that and so on. But what you're saying, it's not going to come to the conclusion. That's what Newton said. It'll give you an indication that you should consider the higher principles like that. And without considering those two sources like Brihadbhagavatamrita, then you won't come to the conclusion that, you know, behind everything is a person and that person loves to steal butter.
Or play the flute.
Or else or has a girlfriend who likes to play the bina. Okay, I guess we should, following Vindaloria's example, he after he made his presentation, he said, I guess I've insulted everybody in the room by now, so I'll probably...
they're afraid of... When they hear God is a person, they're... I have to bow down. I have to... I hear God... I'm going to lose my sense gratification. The Mayavadis think, I'm going to lose my moksha. I have to serve.
Goodness.
I'm a person
again. He'll eat my sandwich. He'll eat my offering. So anyway, I'm going to go and... Okay. Try and find some boards to build a bookcase for our having to pile up our books on. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Highlights of my week here is my little visit to Hawaii.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Wow. Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Bol.
Thank you.
Hare Bol.
Goodbye.